Down to brass tacks.
Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
This is Mohammed Nasser.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, today this morning I heard you talking to a gentleman about the youth and the change and what we have to do to try and... Yeah, see, you had a good conversation with the gentleman about to get this change, to remove some of this suffering and so from our black people, really, as we were talking about. But I want to say, Mr. Ellis, this country, I'm going to keep saying it all the time because there's nobody can challenge it. And every time they talk, come up, it is the same thing. I want to say that in Carden Village, when a young man named Mohammed Nasser opened his own business, I didn't ask that Mohammed had a husband there, that the entire village developed because everybody learned a trade, a skill from that shop. They were learning to do all kinds of things, upholstery, welding, you name it, they're doing reading a rule. We call our people, they're just going to read a rule. But that village developed big off of Husbands Road, a little small place. All were technical people that did not go to university. Orange Hill and St. James. There's a team from down there that also came through that place, Husbands Road, and they have some outstanding young men. Well, this can't be young, no. But some outstanding men who develop massively because of skill. There's, and after last night...
So what do you say?
A young man, he's too young. I say young, but he's probably in the 60s, and you know. He retired from work, and the company had to call him back and ask him to stay on. He was off for 2 years to come back and help them because there's new equipment and new things they want done. And I have to bring him back to do it.
Based on that experience, therefore, what is the recommendation that you have for dealing with the problem?
I'm not going to even say tourism no more. At least not for this conversation with you. My recommendation to this country that when all the party talk done, that the BLP and the DLP are two cousins. The two parties are the same. And we know that because if I find the B and they don't like what they do, I'm going to join the D. And if I find the D and they don't like what they do, I'm going to join the B. So you keep alternating, and their programs are the same. They do not.
So what's the answer?
I tell you the answer. The answer to this problem is to make sure that trade and industry start to develop in this country again.
Now who's going
to
do that?
A lot of the labor laws and so that are handicapping people from employing people because
such
of the labor law.
It's
about young people.
Which labor law? Which labor law
you
is?
You have to find somewhere to limit the restrictions on businesses to employ young people and train them.
Mr. Nasser.
Yeah.
I want specifics. If we as a country are to move forward, then in making this kind of call, you got to give me a little bit more to work with. What are the labor laws that, in your judgment, are hindering businesses from doing that?
Unless there are laws in Barbados, I can't describe it to you by codes and names that are making it very
difficult.
I don't
want codes.
They're making it very difficult for people to employ people. No, don't get me wrong. I'm not talking about adult people who already develop and pay the price to develop. I'm talking about the young people who leave in school now.
So Nasser, that is not going to take us anywhere. If you come and you say there are laws that are creating an obstacle in this way, people won't hear specifically what you're talking about. You can't come and say, well, I don't know. I can't tell you now.
Mr. Ellis, I'll tell you this a simple way. All the time you, as a journalist, you don't know any laws, but I must know all of them, so I can tell you one. The laws where when you employ people, after a certain amount of... I remember, I talk about young people. I'm not talking about people. I want to make this clear. I'm not talking about people who work, make the sacrifice, learn the skills, and develop. The laws, I don't have a problem with that. The laws I have a problem with the ones that are giving the youth the same rights as those people who already suffer and train and make sacrifice to be now adults and top workers or workers. what we are doing is telling my, like me, for instance, I cannot bring two or three or four young men here to learn trade, because after a certain amount of a month, I really ain't got no say over them. The more I can't even afford them. The things, the way to afford them is almost impossible. The restrictions given the young
so people. So you're basically concerned about having people classified as full-time employees after a period. They can, you know, they come in as contract as freelancers, but after a period, you have to treat them as full-time workers. So is that what you're worried about?
It's the worry. You don't get me wrong. At a certain age, you know, don't get me wrong, Mr. Ellis. I am not talking about people like you and me and people who work in it. Well, I work myself, and I suppose you work yourself too, because you're the shareholder in that company. But the point I'm saying, Mr.
Well,
Ellis,
you here, no?
That let me take a young person who now left school, 15 or so, no experience, no nothing at all, and you employ them where they should be learning a skill, because they cannot be doctors and lawyers and engineers. Them the skills too. Why be? They can't be that kind of people. Where they should be learning a skill, and you restricting businesses to give them rights that they do not deserve at that time. When they get good enough, and they will get good enough, I can understand it, but not when they are young trying to develop them. And I'm saying that because I know it is the problem. The problem in Barbados, fundamental problem in Barbados, is that we are not developing, giving our young people the opportunity to develop technical skills. And that is what is causing to get...
Mind you, though, if you're caught with that situation where somebody has been brought on as an apprentice or something like that, and you find that you're going over the period, I think the law allows you to have that person take a break and then come back. So, you know, if you're keen, if the two sides are keen to have that kind of relationship, then you can comply with the law in that regard.
But that makes sense to you, Mr. Ellis. Talented, developing, and they got a break with them for a little bit and then bring them back again.
Well, that's how the law is. That's how the law is, and this is what you have to do. I mean, we've had this employment rights legislation, which has been hailed as such a fantastic piece of legislation for workers. But in watching it play out, employers and employees would by now have seen some elements, some areas in it that they believe may require refinement. And maybe this is the time for us to be looking at making recommendations to government on how this law can be improved. And that may well be one of the issues that you need to look at.
Well, Ms. Ellis, we have to look at it. I am saying to you, sir, that the success of Barbados was the traders, the people who went and learned skills, worked for nothing. I'm not telling you that.
But that is not only applicable to blue-collar workers, though. I mean, people who are working in other areas will face a similar situation. At the end of the day...
I want your name once, so called white-collar worker. You're not working someplace for nothing.
For nothing? I'm not asking. This discussion is not about working for nothing.
For tuppence.
For tuppence?
Do you believe any...
Blue-collar workers tend to be... Generally speaking, blue-collar workers work for more than white-collar workers at that level. Here.
No, you mean when they learn the skill.
When they learn this skill... I suppose even in apprenticeship, you may be shocked to see the kind of money that some of these so-called white collar workers is work for in the especially in the initial stages and stuff like that. It is not
more,
all that is cracked up to be.
They get more out of apprenticeship though than the blue collar workers.
Well, I don't know that. I can't argue that. Anyhow, gotta run. Thank you very much. Down to brass tacks.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ellis.
Hi.
First thing, with all the discussion from the previous callers about job opportunities, let's say there was a job vacancy available in another country that you had the authority to fill from Barbados. A vacancy most people would die for, has a lot of perks, that kind of stuff. Would you promise somebody from your country the job overseas, knowing full well their Jewish citizenship will hinder them from being able to take up the post. As a caring, loving, respecting employer, later on,
When you go buying items, they don't tell buyer beware. In other words, if somebody comes to me and offers me a position, I am the one who is expected to know what my status is and what the implications are. Mm. I can't go and put that responsibility on the other person. I am the one who must be able to say to them, look, I hope you know X, I hope you know Y. And then they're in a better position to determine, well, how am I going to deal with this? So I think that, you know, I am keen to hear from Mr. Clark and from the Barbados Labour Party whether the allegation which has actually been made is true. I don't know that. It has not been confirmed. And the silence and the time that it is taking the BLP to issue something on it, it is either they are playing the political game with it or the longer it takes to say something, the more people start to believe that there must be some truth in it. But at the end of the day, where does this leave Mr. Clark? So the truth of the matter is what we want. Is Franklin's comment, Senator Franklin's comment, true?
Well, I didn't know you could have called names and stuff, so I was trying to go down a...
Well, in a sense, because this is, I mean, it's been reported in the press and everything.
I often hear moderators say, you know, even though something in the press and stuff, you still got to be careful.
I'm saying that it's the kind of charge that that deserves some kind of response.
And, you know, as a government that would have promised before coming to office, transparency and that type of stuff, I must say that I agree with you that we should not have to beg for the information. Like, the information should be up front. And I mean, as you said, you said earlier that if somebody came to you with an offer, you would make sure that everything is in order on your end. But at the same time, I mean, like, it could also be interpreted as the person might...
if I'm at the center of something, I am the one who is expected to know my status.
No, but that doesn't...
So I don't see how you could go casting aspersions on a person who has made an offer to me.
No. Mr. Ellis, let me make it clear. I'm not casting aspersions on anybody, or not. I would have called names from the beginning.
No, sir. Then that's not so. That's not so.
Mr. Ellis, let me make it clear.
That's not so. You used the term just now that clearly... The context, we all knew what you were talking about. Come, don't tell me. Listen, this is not about calling names. If you provide enough information within a particular context, then you don't have to call names. Everybody knows what you're talking about.
Mr. Ellis, I believe...
And you're an intelligent fella, and you know that.
Oh, well, thank you.
I've had to deal with you for many years, so I know what you give, as they say. I know what you gives.
I would take that as a compliment, man.
Well, right? I know that when you're ready, it could be very mischievous too.
Oh, not me, man. You heard Mr. Wickham saying that he likes the second incarnation.
Of you?
Yeah.
You know, after I had to...
You know some of the mischief you got up to with him already. You know from Mr. Wickham to say that he likes this version of me, you know that I really had to improve. Not that I'm trying to say good things about myself.
Well, I don't know which version you're talking about. I don't know. I ain't seen a new version of you.
Oh, dear.
You're just as mischievous as you were before.
No, man. No, a change.
That's all back to...
Mr. Ellis, do you remember the Bible story of the guy that was on the horse going to persecute the Christians? But then he had a turn around. He had an intervention by God, and then he had a turn around. He said, from Paul to Saul, or from Saul to Paul. Yeah, I am on a different road now. I'm on a. Let's say that I'm a follower now of God. So, Mr. Ellis, lastly, on the 6th of August 2020, Mr. Johnson moderated the program. I had called in and I had said that I miss Government Senator Lucille Moore.
Yeah.
Senator Crystal Haynes then called in the same day at 1:14, and during her contribution, she explained that one independent senator was absent because they were sick from morning, and another independent senator was absent because they were sick from lunch. but she stopped short of giving the reason as to why the name of her own colleague, Government Senator Lucy Moore, wasn't called by the clerk during the voting stage. And then last week, the 16th of October, 3 minutes and 40 seconds into the stream uploaded by Parliament, the new president of the Senate said Government Senator Lucy Moore was absent because she was, quote-unquote, overseas on a work assignment. So I just have a few questions before I go on that. What does the president mean by she's overseas on a work assignment? What date did this, quote-unquote, work assignment commence? Is Government Senator Lucille Moore on public business or private business? And if she's on public business, shouldn't the taxpayers have a right to get at least an idea as to what the trip is about? How long is the work assignment going to last? And lastly, if Tony Moore isn't successful at the St. George North Polls, would Ms. Moore replace Lucille Moore as the newest government senator? Thank you, Ms. Ellis.
Well, pertinent questions. So I can't answer them. The government would have to answer them for you. Down to brass tacks. Hello? Welcome to the program. It's 1:20.
All right, Ms. Ellis?
Hi.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. I want to make a query.
Mm-hmm.
Relative to the donation of blood, we got people in this country who for years have been donating blood and they go and truthfully and do it. But yet, you still hear there's a shortage and so. Blood is a resource that is an abundant supply amongst our people that people don't donate. They don't go. But you ask them to come and donate as a civic duty. But I see the blood like a natural resource. And when you are mining or harvesting or whatever natural resources, it begins to be had. But the abundance of the blood is in the poor population. The poor population is in the masses, so they got more blood. And I realize that anything that poor people got, it should be cheap or it should be free. Nobody don't want to pay for it. And anything that anybody of any substance have, you got to pay through your ears for it. I am saying that blood for the survival of humankind is so important. And the same way that you could pay a consultant $30,000 a month or $40,000, why can't you give a person when they donate a pint of blood $100 Barbados dollars? If you can move squatters and get them a whole spot, give them a whole spot valuable, $80,000. If you pay everybody that donated blood for a whole year, $100, when they donate it, it can't come to $80,000.
Have you ever donated blood?
Yes.
What motivated you to do it?
I was asked at the time, and I went.
And why did you go? Because somebody was close to you? Or they were close to somebody who was close to you?
No, I had belonged somewhere at the time, mm-hmm. and they asked that you go and do what and do and make a donation, do part of make it part of your duty to do it.
You felt you should have been paid then?
No.
Why not?
And I don't want to be paid, but I am saying they got people in this country that are struggling. They don't know.
So you wanted to sell the blood? In other words,
yes.
As a means of getting through in life, sell their blood?
Yes. You know why? You just sell your talent. You just get paid every for when you go work. And if a man goes and he ain't got nothing else.
You know, there are a lot of people in this country who would refuse to be paid for donating blood. They have they have a completely different perspective on it.
But Ms. Ellis, when you go work, you just want to get paid, right? And they got people that are struggling. And if they got a resource, they should be paid.
Have you heard from people who have told you that they would like to give blood, but they're not going to do it because they ain't getting paid? Anybody ever tell you that?
Let me ask you a question. Mm. When the squatters were at by the airport, they tell you they won't go out there because they're going to get land when they go out there. They used to show about the get land. So what I'm saying to you, if you put a facility in place that a man can get $100, no, but that's your view. Let me express my view. Mm-hmm. My view is, if you put something there that a man can say, well, look, boy, things tight with me, I want $100, and he going to duly appoint it here positive that the bank short hand. You won't got no problems with shortage of blood no more because people will say, well, oh, and they will go and donate the blood. I mean, they got people that can do it for free, but they got people that will do it because there's an incentive to doing it.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, if there's a way, because, I mean, if you get sick tomorrow and you want 2 points or positive and they ain't got it, it's a problem. I want the blood to be in abundance. But what I'm saying, create the environment whereby you're going to create the surpluses. That is all. Thank you.
All right, well, that's your opinion. You're entitled to it. Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hello. Hello. Good
Welcome
afternoon.
To the program. Hi.
Thank you. Stelis, the main problem I feel in Barbados and all the violence and so on among the youth is indiscipline. And I think we've reached a stage where we have indisciplined parents with indisciplined children. And that cycle has to be broken.
I would like you to pay attention to the age groups that are turning up in the newspaper. They're not all that young anymore.
Yeah, this but if they are not on the right track, young, when they get to the age that you're talking about, like 20, a little bit and so on.
No, I ain't talking about the 20 nothing neither. I'm talking about men who are now in their mid to late 30s and 40s, in particular, people who have graduated from one stage of crime to the next. All right,
yes, it's
bigger than just youth.
If you don't start out with discipline of the youth, then that will continue on and on.
That means putting lashes in them on a day? That's what discipline means? What do we mean by discipline?
A compulsory youth service. That is what I mean. A compulsory youth service, you're in for 2 years. If you leave school and you're not going on to tertiary education or you're not going into a job, come in for 2 years. When I finish with you, you're going to come up with a skill and you'll be disciplined. And that, to me, will break the cycle.
Well, if you think so.
Sorry?
If you think that by itself will do it. But let me ask you, so why is it that...
Mm-hmm.
If after 40 years of talking about a youth service, we ain't got none, what do you think that is?
Exactly. And that is
why. Tell me why.
A government must have the guts to do it. Once I was speaking to a politician about it, and at the end of it, he said to me, but how that going to affect the vote? You know? So that's all he was thinking about, the vote, rather than thinking about the country.
Because
the
this,
good that
this,
can do for the country.
This country is made up of a lot of people who would say that my child is a good child and a youth service is for bad children. And therefore, my child is not to go into that. Because if you take my child and put him in there, he's going to mix with these bad behaved people. And the next thing you know, he or she will turn out just like them. In any case, because of the class of society from whence I come, and there are many people in Barbados who think like that, that is not for my child. Do you understand that is why, after all these years of talking, it has gone nowhere?
David, then if it's not for my child, let my child go to school and get some kind of skill. Or let my child go to work, or let my child continue on to university education or something like that, but not for my child to be under the street or lying doing nothing. Not afford it.
And I got people who work a little bit and lame a lot. They will tell you that they are not totally unemployed. It's simply that they don't want too much work. You know, there's something, and then they get into trouble with, you know, the peer groups and stuff like that. You know, sometimes you wonder, you say, but suppose I grew up, I was a boy in a period like this where your peers sit down and they smoke a spliff, and they take the spliff and they share it with one another and that sort of thing. To what extent would you, a lot of people who are men today, grown men, getting elderly and stuff now, would they have been able to resist that pressure? I mean, a lot of them in the past were with groups that used to beat up people when they passed through the neighborhood and that sort of thing. Who like to throw stones. Men could not leave one place to go and court a woman because the fellas in the neighborhood would be, you know, they cut guava sticks and all sorts. Because a lot of people who talk the talk were pretty violent in their day. But they laugh at it because they would say, oh, the difference is we didn't used to shoot nobody. We didn't used to cut up nobody. But there was a lot of violence. And I want to submit to you that a lot of what is playing out in Barbados now is as a result. What's happening there? A lot of what is playing out in Barbados now is just its foundations began a long time ago. So, you know, we talk as though this is something that the motive has long been there. Yeah. This is down to brass tacks. This call is sounding a little noisy. So let's move on. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Mr. Ellis?
Hi.
The whole issue of this crime and scanning, etc. No. Everybody wants to go the way of digitization. And scanners are part of that. But they view it, and there's both governments have come has run from one end to the other, where they think that the scanners and digitization would mean less staff to physically do the work. But it's not working. Because, for instance, you have a container, and you bring this big, elaborate scanner, and you're looking for a needle in a haystack. You scan your container, you're not going to pick up guns or ammunition with that type of scanner. It would have to be in a very large quantity to pick it up. So you're looking for a needle in a haystack. So you need now to change, reevaluate what you're doing, bring a different policy. You have scanners. Are the scanners there? Do they have the capacity to pick up what you want? Are the workers skilled enough to operate those scanners?
That's training,
and what you want. If you look.
But that's not, that's about, is that about numbers or is that about skill?
Numbers and skill. Because if you look there at the, next to the commissioner's comments, or the comments attributed to the commissioner, you will see that overseas where they have found those weapons, etc. Now, they did a scan, but then the search, I had to search again because I found car parts, and then they're going to find something else, because that is how the system works for customs. That you, it's not just about having pretty software and whatever. Because
yeah, but you're implying that
go ahead.
In their case, it was about numbers, and that the
not
numbers,
only numbers.
No,
not
you're,
only
you're
numbers.
Implying that the numbers made the difference there.
There's no that whenever you scan, you must have the people then to do the necessary checks. But of course, they must have the skills. The skill set must be there as well. It can't be only about the skill. If you have, let's say, 10 containers and you scan them, as I say, the scanner will be looking for a needle in a haystack. If you look at the size of, let's say, a 40-foot container, and let's say each 40-foot container had in two guns, the chances of you picking up two guns on that scanner is like zero.
I think that whatever you do out there must be complemented by what is happening internally, and part of that is the intelligence gathering and stuff.
Ah, there you go now.
But another
so you're looking at the supply chain.
But another part of it has to do with movement on the ground. And Barbados is, to me, it looks as though we are not intercepting enough. We do a pretty good job in the police force of being able to solve the crime at the end of the process. But what we need more of is the prevention. And if these people have all of these guns and it is recognized that we have not been able to stem the flow, then the next logical question is, so what are we doing on the ground recognizing this? And most people believe that there's got to be a police and a joint police and army presence on these streets to a greater degree to see if we can stop this movement here and there. I mean, the ridiculous situation right now of men, three and four men driving about in a car and walking about here, you know, driving around the place, creating trouble in some areas. And let me tell you, one thing is sure, is that when you see rats, we don't have any idea of how bad this situation really is. You know, a lot of things happening in here that you never get reported. They are actually happening. And this gun violence has to, we need more of a presence on the ground in Barbados to at least restrict the movement of some of these bad people who are just concerned with creating mayhem. They don't care.
Let's put it for a car. You have a car, and unless you get gas to put in that car, eventually you can't move it. So if you try now to minimize, coordinate with the same overseas people, the customs and whatever other territory that are intercepting some of these guns to see the origin. Because in this day, when you ship goods, normally you have to put your photograph is available there in the other region, let's say in the U.S., to take your photograph, etc. So if we coordinate with them to try to stop, let's say, the ammunition from coming, so then the man might have guns, but my God, hit you with them because they won't be able to shoot nothing. You got to find a way to retool and come to a different realization where you switch now and say, well, look, all right, we have guns on the street, but let me stop the ammunition. So you got to find a different outlook as to how to cut off the supply to the criminals.
Well, people are paid to do that job. They're the ones that we expect to analyze the situation and come up with strategies that will make a difference.
Are they doing it?
Well, they may be doing it to some degree. The many times that they may, the times that they succeed, we will never know about that. Because largely, you know, if you're going to pick up 78 guns over a period, you know, that doesn't mean that you've made 78 arrests. And therefore, you know, you would have to come and tell the public, as we've been told now, that this is what has happened. But when somebody is shot, many times you hear about it. Not all the time, because there are things that are happening, as I tell you already, that people don't, they're not reported in the way that you would expect them to be reported for whatever reason. Because again, this is something you got to take into consideration. When you're running a country like this, that you got tourists and you're trying to do the Barbados stamp and all of that, you can expect that there are some things that the authorities will keep under wraps because of what will be described as security reasons, right? So those of us who have been around long enough understand those things. Down to brass tacks. Watch this final presidential debate last night. I've been looking to see what the reaction has been. There were about three polls that were conducted, what they call instant polls. And they suggest, and I'll read this piece for you from Vox is what they call it. The final presidential debate is in the books. And the first polls are in, and they suggest Donald Trump didn't get the shakeup he desperately needed. Now, as usual, I remind you to take these polls with some grains of salt. They're limited to people who actually watch the debate rather than the broader electorate. And they don't take into account the spin wars and media narratives that will help shape voters' understanding of what happened. But of course, you crave the instant gratification of learning who won shortly after it happened, rather than waiting for more rigorous data. So I'll deliver it to you. The three instant polls we have so far both found that it says the three instant polls we have so far found that most debate watchers thought that Joe Biden won the debate. What, I don't know if you watched it, what do you think? This is Down to Brass Tacks. Hello?
Good afternoon, sir.
Yes, sir.
I watched it, and I think Joe Biden ran away with it for true. Anyway, I want to respond to three things that was said to you in short order not long ago. One is the guy that spoke about his scanners. I want to tell him that those scanners can see right through metal, and they can see any minute thing in the containers. That's one. Two, they're concentrating the efforts on the Bridgestone port and the airport. But I want to tell the authorities that our shorelines, our borders are very porous. And anything can happen on the borders, on the coastlines. And I have proof to that. And the last thing I want to say to you is that the fellow who spoke about blood, I agree with him. I see a couple of Sundays ago on the Sunday evening medical program, and I was speaking to a hematologist, I said that it is high time in this country that the government should offer people some kind of incentive so that they can come in and give blood freely. Because if a fella know that he can go and give a pint of blood or whatever amount it is that you normally would give and get some kind of stipend, $100, $150, whatever, and he could go and do that, and his blood is proven to be good blood, and he gets that money, that's where you need to bring people into the blood bank to donate blood. I said that to a hematologist a couple of times ago, and she told me. And I also told her, I know in Miami, people go into the blood banks and sell their blood. I can't remember how much money they get for it. And she said that they don't buy blood, they buy plasma. You know, she's a hematologist and I'm not. But I know that plasma is a part of the blood component because there's a lot of things in the blood. There's white cells, red cells, cancer, plasma, all kinds of things in the blood. Blood clots, all kinds of things. So I you was talking with the fella and you was asking a lot of questions to me that don't make no sense. And the fellow was correct that the government should give people some kind of incentive and encourage them to go and give blood. That way, the government won't go to the hospital, won't go to be begging people to come and give blood. I wanted to give blood some time ago and I couldn't because I suffered with a blood clot before.
Well, I don't know how the society has changed and if it is to that degree that people do not give blood only because they don't have an incentive to do so. You and the caller may be right. I don't know. I come from an understanding over the years that people gave blood because they felt a commitment to helping other people in difficult circumstances.
I agree.
And there are many people who relatives will come to you and say, but, you know, somebody from my family is very ill. And I'd like, you know, we need you to give blood, and people willingly do so.
I agree.
You may very well be right that the society has changed in that regard, and therefore the only thing that is stopping people. I don't know if you know anybody. You see, none of the questions I may ask made sense, so I can ask you one that don't make no sense. You know anybody out there who told you that they don't give blood because they don't get paid for it?
I know people that don't get blood because they're Jehovah's Witnesses. But you what you just said,
I told you I was going to ask you a foolish question, so I'm going to ask you again. You know anybody who says, I'm not giving blood because they don't pay me for it?
But David, will you just say it's correct when you said that people ask people to give blood, and people give blood for humanitarian reasons. All of that I agree with. But the point I am trying to make to you, sir, is that if you give people incentives, you won't got to go about begging for blood because you will always have a lot of blood in your bank, in the blood bank. That's the point.
How can you guarantee that? On what basis do you say that we have this large catchment of people out there who will say, well, I will give blood because I'm being paid. And on the other side, we say, you know, I'm not doing it because I don't get any money for it.
But Alice, listen to me. I understand what you're saying, you know, but you don't understand what you're saying. All I am saying to you is simply this. If you tell a fellow you come and give a pint of blood, or whatever amount it normally is, I'm going to give you $150. Don't you think that people will be lining up over the blood?
I don't know. Because, first of all, to give blood, you have to reach a certain threshold when it comes to being healthy.
Correct.
We got a lot of people in this country who don't like to go to the doctor because they don't want to know what their status is in that regard.
True.
So,
I agree.
All right? That's to begin with.
I agree. Ellis, let me tell you, I'm 66 years old. And I go as the doctor, I get a complete checkup twice a year. At the beginning of the year and in the middle of the year. Every year he does that. And I'm frightened for the doctor. Because if you go to the doctor often enough, you won't go to the need to get scared for the doctor. But it is when you don't go to the doctor and you don't try to find out about the status of your health, that those are the people that don't want to go to the doctor because it's like, well, I've had the doctor for 4 years or 5 years and I'm afraid to go and do blood or whatever.
All I know, we haven't even been able to assess the extent to which COVID has caused a lot of people to be afraid of going for their normal checkups and that sort of thing.
But like I tell you, I'm afraid of the doctor now. I do what I got to do, and I try to do it
that's you.
Best way possible.
That's you.
I try to do it the best. Let me tell you something, Mr. Ellis. You see this COVID, I watch this MSNBC a whole lot. And if you watch MSNBC and hear them talking about the COVID, or you listen to the BBC and hear them talking about the COVID, it will frighten you. To the point where you would want to go all your mask, even if you're getting the bath to be it. That's how serious this thing is. And until business understand that, we can got some careless people in this country. And I would like the radio stations to promote this thing, tell people more about the things that they ought to do to avoid the spread of this thing in this country.
All right, sir. Thank you very much for your contribution. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, welcome.
Yeah, you know, listening to this program, you can understand a lot of Bajans don't know what's really going on in Barbados. In Barbados, we have something that's called organized crime. Sometimes when a person gets shot, that's called from the top. If you really want to solve crime in this country, and you have nothing to do with black and white, and I'm speaking from experience, if you want to solve crime in this country, some of those people at the top, they need to come out. You need to lock up those people. If you lock up a man that murdered and do this and do that, it ain't that solving the problem because the people that you're supposed to target, you are not targeting. And that's happening because who I know and who know me. But Bajans know that and people forging to talk in this country. Now, I can't go no further. No, Gamma will pay me a visit, so you take care of yourself.
You heard what he said? And they talking from experience, okay? All right. Down to brass tacks. And
good afternoon,
there
David.
He demonstrates the fear. I'm okay.
All right. Let me just say that I'm going to call again for the Attorney General of Barbados to speak to the nation of Barbados concerning the rising level of gun crime in this country. I spoke to you, I think it was last week, on this matter, and I had suggested that he make an appearance on this Sunday down to Brass Tacks. And you also indicated to me that you made a similar request to have him address the nation, whether it's on Brass Tacks or whatever, and you've gotten no response. No, here's what I intend to do. I intend to call Brass Tacks at least once every week and make this call again until the Attorney General of Barbados sees the necessity to speak to the nation of Barbados, whether by radio, television, or whatever, and address this problem of escalating gun crime in Barbados. What are your thoughts on that, David?
Well, you know, I learned a long time ago that when it came to things like that, I don't beg nobody for nothing. I'm telling you because they got some people in public life who develop their own perspectives on you and your job. And you set about, and for me, the critical thing here is to have a certain line as a journalist, as an independent media host and stuff like that, which will mean that from time to time, there are situations that will arise where you have to ask people in responsible positions to talk to the public and that sort of thing. But a lot of people have developed a kind of, you see it in the United States, where there is a process of manipulation of the media. You got to go to the media house that you think is favorable to you. Trump does it all the time. I watched the interview there with Leslie Stahl, and that was, it was pathetic how Trump was behaving in the interview. She was putting to him the issues that she has picked up along the way to put him in a position to respond to these concerns, for putting the issues to him. This is how the system has changed. The notion of democracy has changed. And there are people outside of America who carry the same mentality that you get from President Trump. I have seen this in some of the people who were in government before, and I fear that it could happen again. So I'm not going to be here trying to do that kind of thing of begging anybody to speak to the public and that sort of thing, because me to talk to, you're talking to the public. And if they want to, they will come. If they don't want to come, they will stay wherever they are. If you want to call for them to come to talk to you, you can do that. One thing I can assure you of, as I said before, if they come to talk to you through me, I am not compromising my professionalism and my journalistic integrity for anybody as long as I do this kind of work. You know, they got people who got all types of things to say about journalists and what journalists are and this and that. But there's one thing I try to make sure of as I come closer and closer to the evening of my career. I am not going to let anybody say that I sell out anybody this way. That is not me. And therefore, the thing is happening on the ground. Everybody in Barbados can see what has been happening. The Attorney General spoke in opposition. He is now the Attorney General. And gun violence in particular, notwithstanding all that was done, and I want to say this, it is heartening to open the paper in particular and see that crimes committed back in 2012 and before are now being heard at last. You have to give that to him and the government. But at the same time, there are some other things that you want to hear about. You want to put him in a position to be quizzed and to give you satisfactory answers as to why we are getting nowhere in some areas. So that's where I stand on it. I'm not begging for it. Down to brass tacks. You're on the air. It's now 1:55, so we have time for one more call.
Hello.
Yes, welcome to the program.
Yeah, David. Thank you, Dennis, for giving me information last week. I was in New York, and I came in Tuesday. I just want to shed a little light with you. You there?
Yes.
Okay. I took my test in New York on the 18th, Sunday. Came in Tuesday. Smooth sailing. Came to the airport. The bus picked us up and brings us to the airport. Came to the villa and quarantine there. On the Wednesday morning, the monitoring team was here. Then get a call and informed me I have to go to the Polytechnic in Warrens. I took the test there, and I got a result this morning saying that I'm negative. So I just want to congratulate the minister and all who are in charge of the COVID team and whoever, that is good service, just as good as New York or better.
Now, how does it leave you feeling, actually?
Great, great.
You having to go through this process?
Well, it wasn't a big thing. I did my nose in New York, two nostrils. Mm-hmm. Put something up your nose. And then they came here. They did the same thing, but they only did one nostril here.
So how does it feel to come here?
Oh, great. Great. It's free. It's free, you know.
How long? Well, we're talking so much about your test. The test is it, you know. But
yeah.
It is the feeling of... How long you were in New York planning this trip here?
Since March. I spoke to you. The last time I spoke to you was by Nova Zone when you asked me what...
Since March.
So March, they go, They keep canceling all the time. They keep canceling. But this time, I finally made it.
Okay.
Because the airline was canceling and then the standards and then, you know, a lot of rigmarole.
So what are your plans now that you're back?
Well, I have two fellas here, so I just relaxing now. But I'm free to go now, but I just relaxing and was just listening to you this morning. The lady was criticizing. But I want to thank the people. The people here is up to speed with New York. The nurses and doing this COVID stuff. That's why I really call to educate you on that.
Well, I want
to let people know.
Thank you very much for your intervention. It really is good to have you back home after all this.
The only one negative I saw, right? Mm-hmm. When I came in the airport, they put you on a bus with everybody, 20 people. I think that was wrong, but because when you get to the, they take you from the gate, past the gate and gone up and then to the east end. And then everybody get off there. Who had the letters? Or they went down that way, the negative test, and who didn't have to go the other way. But I thought the people with negative could have just gone through that gate and then they pick the ones that are negative in the bus and go up.
Right.
That's the only thing I see that I would speak on.
All right.
The service is beautiful, David.
Thank you very much.
Dennis again. No, I brought my thermometer in because of Dennis, too. Because of Dennis, he educated me on that. I didn't know that.
Okay.
I have to take my fever for 7 days. Anyway, I listened to you from New York.
We got to go.
And now I'm in Barbados, and we talk. Okay,
we got to go.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's it for today's edition of Down to Brass Tacks. I'm David Ellison. On behalf of Dennis Johnson, I want to thank you very much, all of you. Those of you who were the good callers, and those of you who were the troublesome callers as well. Thank you all.